The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Capital Thinking. It's a very interesting day with the president scheduled to speak tonight on immigration reform. We're going to get to that later in the show. We're also going to talk about international trade issues. But we're going to talk about one of the hot topics of November here in Washington, D.C., and that's net neutrality. Joining us for this segment is Jack Nadler, one of my colleagues and partners here in Washington, D.C. And many of you will have seen that President Obama jumped into this debate just recently by calling for the strongest possible rules about net neutrality. And we're going to talk to Jack, who's got a long career in the telecommunications area about this. I don't want to say he's old, but I think cell phones weighed about 10 pounds when and there was no internet when Jack started in this area. So,
hell, Kevin, there were barely cell phones.
Yeah, there you go. So, Jack, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking, and maybe start out by enlightening the audience just a little bit about what net neutrality actually means.
Sure, Kevin. I'm really happy to be here. One of the problems with the net neutrality debate is that there isn't a real agreement on what net neutrality even means. At a bare minimum, net neutrality is a set of rules governing the relationship between what we call broadband providers, companies like Comcast and Verizon that own the infrastructure, and what the FCC likes to call edge providers, the Amazons and YouTubes, Googles of the world, the people with content. Everybody, I think, agrees at a minimum, net neutrality means that users of the internet have the right to access any lawful site they want. A broadband provider can't say, I don't like that site, my customers can't get access to that. Net neutrality also usually is understood to mean that broadband providers can't unilaterally discriminate among edge providers. So, for example, a Verizon or a Comcast can't say, we like this political content on this website, we're going to give them fast access, we really don't like the political content on that website, we're going to slow down the access to that website. We're going to make it harder for our customers to access one site or another. Fairly broad consensus that net neutrality ought to prohibit that. Where things get controversial is when you deal with the question of, can a broadband provider and an edge provider voluntarily agree to an arrangement in which the edge provider pays more money in return for access to a fast lane on the internet. That is, the edge provider says, I'm willing to pay more money so that my content gets to my customers more quickly. That is called paid prioritization. At the end of the day, Kevin, the net neutrality debate really comes down to one thing. Will the FCC and can the FCC ban paid prioritization completely? or should it be allowed at least under some circumstances?
You know, so paid prioritization is a very interesting issue, Jack. When I think about, you know, I have a little device in my car that lets me take the toll lanes so that I can get to town faster. When I go to Busch Gardens or Kings Dominion Amusement Parks, I can pay to cut to the front of the line. So what exactly is so bad about paid prioritization in this context?
Well, the opponents of paid prioritization say this would destroy the internet as we know it today. In their view, the power of the internet is that everybody is treated the same. The smallest garage startup, the fringiest political group can have their traffic delivered to end users exactly as fast as the biggest, most established websites and the most mainstream parties. The concern is that the internet has worked well using this model. If it were to change, this would harm innovation. It would put the startups at a disadvantage. It would stifle free speech. On the other hand, the people that are in favor of paid prioritization reject all that. They say this is just business as usual. In this world, if you pay more money, you get better treatment. Indeed, even common carriers, the telephone company, you can buy a voice grade line, or if you're a big company, you can buy a big high speed data line. You can get dial up internet or you can get broadband internet.
So I love this as a typical Washington policy debate. You got one camp that says it's business as usual. You have another camp that says, no, it's the end of the internet as we know it if you don't fix this. I feel like we've seen this movie before, Jack. I feel like the FCC went down this path. They actually had a rule and something happened. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. Kevin, you make a great point. I think a lot of the net neutrality debate really is theology. It's people with two very extreme views, those on the one hand that say this is the end of the earth, the other who's saying, gee, there's no problem. Why are we bothering? Why is the government coming in to regulate the internet? And as we'll talk about in a little bit, I think the FCC chairman is one of the few people in town who's trying to strike a very sensible middle ground. But you're right. We have been down this road before. Way back in 2010, the FCC actually adopted net neutrality rules. And they adopted at that time three rules. The original rules made a distinction between wireline internet, that is the internet you get from the phone company or your cable company, and mobile internet, and put much stronger restrictions on wireline internet services. But basically three rules. All broadband providers, fixed and mobile, were required to disclose information about how do you run your network, do you slow anybody down, do you have any kind of prioritization, letting people know and make informed decisions. And that has not been terribly controversial. The second rule was a no-blocking rule. Again, as we talked about, a rule that said that carriers, broadband providers, can't block access to any lawful site. And there were some legal issues about that, but again, not all that controversial. But the clincher was the so-called no unreasonable discrimination rule that said, at least as applied to fixed broadband providers, you cannot unreasonably discriminate in the transmission of traffic. All of which is kind of Washington speak for no paid prioritization.
I see. So, you know, the FCC has these open internet rules, and I'm wondering about not just the legal basis for them, but when you read some of the commentary here, you get some people who really question whether or not the FCC has any jurisdiction given to it by Congress to actually regulate the internet at all.
Great question, Kevin, and this has been a hard problem. The FCC actually tried several years before 2010 to impose some restrictions on Comcast in an order that got struck down. The FCC has struggled over the years to figure out what is its legal basis for regulating broadly the internet, or in particular, this relationship between the broadband internet providers and the edge providers. And in 2010, they came on a somewhat obscure provision that Congress added in 1996 when they rewrote the old 34 Act. That provision we call Section 706, which I'll just read a couple of the relevant words, directs the FCC to encourage the deployment of advanced telecommunications capability by utilizing regulating methods that remove barriers to infrastructure investment. Now, the FCC for many years had said, well, that's just kind of a direction to us to do our job. But in 2010, they kind of had a change of heart and said, you know, we just realized this is actually a grant of substantive authority to us to do things that we're not allowed. We have no authority anywhere else in the Telecommunications Act to do, as long as we can justify it as reasonably necessary to promote investment in infrastructure.
Yes. Okay. So let's talk about that. What's the correlation here between having net neutrality and removing barriers to infrastructure?
Great question. It's not an obvious connection why having net neutrality rules will promote investment in infrastructure. But the FCC had what sometimes been called the triple shot theory, which is basically net neutrality rules will encourage investment by the edge providers, that these new innovative startups will say, well, if the FCC assures us a level playing field, we're going to put the money in and try to start the next big thing sites. If there are more innovative sites, the FCC said, well, that's going to increase demand for broadband internet access because there'll be consumers that say, well, there's all this great new innovative stuff on the internet. We really want to upgrade to broadband and have fast access to that. And then the FCC said, well, if there's more consumer broadband demand for broadband internet, then the broadband providers will deploy more broadband infrastructure. Therefore, net neutrality rules will create increased investment in infrastructure.
All right. Well, so tell me a little bit what happened to the 2010 rules of the FCC.
Well, like everything else the FCC does, these rules were taken to court. And back in January of this year, in a case known as Verizon v. FCC, the court struck down the second and the third rule, that is, the no blocking and the no unreasonable discrimination rule.
Gotcha. And was there any sort of language in there in the court opinion about this Section 706 that you mentioned earlier?
That was really the big surprise. A lot of people, me included, thought 706 was a pretty shaky foundation for the FCC to build this structure on, you know, especially given the fact that for many, many years, the FCC had taken exactly the opposite position, that 706 didn't give it any new authority. It was just a direction to go out and do its job using the powers it already had. But the court, to a lot of people's surprise, at least by a 2-1 majority, agreed with the FCC, and they read 706 in extraordinarily broad terms. Basically, the court said, as long as this is related to the communications field, and as long as there's some reasonable explanation about why some FCC action will promote broadband investment, 706 grants the FCC pretty much whatever powers it wants to do to adopt the rules.
Let me cut you off there, Jack. I think we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll come back in a minute. We'll talk some more about net neutrality and the future for policymakers here. You're listening to Capital Thinking.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The United States faces a moral crisis that strikes at the very heart of our democracy. Americans who live in our nation's capital have no representation in Congress. Like American citizens in the 50 states, they pay federal taxes, fight and die in wars. But when our heroes come home, they are stripped of a basic political right that most of us take for granted. They have no voice in our national legislature. D.C. deserves equal representation in Congress. Go to dcvote.org to learn how you can help end this injustice.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Need to keep up to date with regulatory matters? Looking to expand your business globally? We've got enviable connections in D.C., Brussels, and beyond with commercially focused teams to advise on the current and future legislation that you need to know about. With 44 offices in 21 countries located in major global cities, we can make that happen. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Kevin O'Neill with you here on Capital Thinking, joined by my colleague Jack Nadler, a partner at Squire Patton Boggs, where he has long practiced in the telecommunications space. And we are talking about President Obama's proposals on net neutrality and their impact, how that'll play out at the Federal Communications Commission. We were talking about the recent court decision that relied on Section 706 of 2010 rules from the FCC. And, Jack, I was a little bit confused because on the one hand, it seems like the circuit is saying, hey, you can rely on that provision to actually promulgate these rules, but then they actually strike down the rule that the FCC had promulgated. Walk me through that.
Sure. It's a little complicated, but let's try to make it simple.
I'm a simple man, so that'd be best.
Excellent. That's why we do so well together. As I said, the court said Section 706 is a really broad grant of authority to do things that the FCC isn't authorized to do anyplace else in the Communications Act, unless it crosses some limit expressly put on the FCC's authority. And that's exactly what happened here. Let me take a half a step back. In the telecom world, we distinguish between telecom services and information services. Telecom service, basic, moving my information from me to you because I said send it there, real time, no change, pure transparent transmission, sort of like making a telephone call. Could be voice, could be data. On the other hand, we have a category called information service, and those are things that are built on top of transmission. That's accessing a website. That's all kinds of interacting with, manipulating, accessing, storing data. There are two different kinds of rules. For information services are subject to a very light touch kind of regulation. Telecom services, on the other hand, can be subject to public utility or common carrier regulation on what's called Title II of the Communications Act. And as we'll talk about, there's been a lot of talk of reclassification. Back about 10, 12, 15 years ago now, the FCC, during the Bush years, reclassified broadband internet service as a single information service. Before that, they said it was two services in one. It was a telecom service and an information service. They reviewed it. So we have broadband internet access classified as a telecom service. Now, there's a provision in the Communications Act that says, FCC, you can only impose common carrier requirements on telecom providers. You can't impose common carrier requirements. You can't impose Title II on information services. And that is exactly what the court said the FCC had done.
So how does the court reach the conclusion they got there?
Okay. Basically, again, paid prioritization was the key issue. What the ban on paid prioritization essentially means is that a broadband provider has to treat every edge provider exactly the same. And in what way are they treated exactly the same? The broadband provider has to deliver the edge provider's traffic at a cost of zero. Paid prioritization means you're not allowed to provide access to a fast lane in return for more money. So the court said that's exactly like common carriage. That's saying you have to treat every provider, every potential customer exactly the same. You've got to provide them service, and you've got to provide them service on the same prices, terms, and conditions, only here the price, term, and condition is you got to do it for free.
Very interesting. So if I'm the FCC, I'm a little unhappy, obviously, that my rule has been struck down, and also maybe a little bit worried about how do I find a path forward. So what was their reaction?
Well, Chairman Wheeler's initial reaction, which I think was a very sound one, was to go back, look very carefully at the order, and say, there's a lot of good stuff here. We won, the FCC won a big victory in the Section 706 authority. How do we salvage as much as we can and jettison what we have to? And so what he came up with and what was issued for comment by the FCC was a proposal to stick with 706, strengthen the transparency rules, keep no blocking, although with a little change in the legal rationale, and instead of the absolute ban on paid prioritization, replace that with a requirement that would allow arrangements between edge providers and broadband providers as long as they were commercially reasonable. What this would have done is it would have allowed some but not all paid prioritization.
So tell me, before we get to the president, obviously the president has taken action designed to push the FCC along, but where was the FCC in this process between the court case and the president's announcement last week?
Well, Kevin, the FCC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, and they got 4 million comments, many of which were very strongly against allowing any form of paid prioritization. This was actually the second largest number of comments the FCC ever received. You want to guess what the first one was?
It had to have something to do with Kim Kardashian.
You're very close. I'll give you two words.
Oh, Janet
Wardrobe
Jackson.
Wardrobe malfunction.
Janet Jackson.
You nailed it, Kevin. There's a reason you're sitting in the big chair. All right. So the FCC realized, the chairman realized the politics were getting out in front of him, and so he had to make a little bit of a move and came up with, floated an idea about a hybrid solution which would have mixed some elements of Title II and some elements of Section 706. But before that really got a lot of traction, the president came out with his proposal.
Yeah, so why is the president wading in here? What exactly is his public position now?
Well, the president's position is that the FCC should adopt the strongest possible rules, that basically the FCC should reclassify broadband internet access as a telecom service, use Title II, and ban all forms of paid prioritization. Now, why is the president doing it? This is really an extraordinary thing. maybe you can. I can't ever remember a case where a sitting president came out and publicly intervened in this way in a proceeding that was before an independent regulatory authority.
Now, when I see what happened when the president came out, I seem to recall AT&T's president very quickly announcing that they were going to suspend infrastructure investment because all of a sudden the ground beneath their feet is shifting when you're trying to reclassify. And so I guess my question is, if I'm AT&T's lawyers or Verizon's lawyers, I'm looking really hard for a way to say you don't actually have the legal authority to reclassify.
Yeah, I think reclassification... There are two problems with reclassification. First, doing it is hard. The words in the Telecom Act actually have meaning. The service that broadband providers to end users is indisputably an information service. You access new information. What the FCC would have to do is sort of carve out, go back to what they were doing 15 years ago, carve out a telecom component, apply Title II to that. And that's very complicated technically, and it also raises a whole host of other problems. Like, for example, AT&T would then have to pay universal service fees over 16-17% on broadband revenue, which it now doesn't have to do. The irony of this is, in my view, not only would Title II cause all of these problems, political and technical and legal, but it actually wouldn't let the FCC ban paid prioritization.
So, real quickly, Jack, tell me a little bit about what you think the FCC is looking to do and how you think this is going to play out.
Sure. Chairman Wheeler really wanted to make this issue go away. This was not the issue he wanted to define his chairmanship, but he really wanted this done in December. That's clearly not going to happen. What he's got to do is walk a tightrope. He's got four other commissioners, two Democrats, two Republicans. There is nothing he can do other than give up on net neutrality that will be supported by the Republicans. He's got two Democrats who are to the left of him on this issue and are probably about where the president is. So he's got to find a way to get as basically ban enough paid prioritization to keep them on the reservation while at the same time coming up with an order that can withstand judicial review and that won't spark deter investment and spark a firestorm on the Hill, which is exactly what would happen if the FCC were to use Title II.
So you got an end prediction here of how what finally happens?
Yeah. I think the chairman is going to go with something along the lines of this hybrid. I think the two other Democrats are going to be unhappy, but what choice do they have? Wait and see if the next chairman, who could be a Republican, is going to be more sympathetic? I don't think so. So I think he grudgingly drags them along. And depending on how far, whatever he does, it's going to go to court. And this is, may well all get struck down again. And of course, the Republican majority is clearly going to watch this. There are already plans for oversight hearings even now. So I think the one thing that's certain is it'll be probably the second quarter of next year before we see new rules. Whatever the FCC has done is going to stay in court. And so, Kevin, I suspect about a year from now, we're going to be back here having the same discussion.
Very good. Well, we will certainly not wait a year to have Jack Nadler back to talk about net neutrality and developments here. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the president's plans to speak from the White House tonight on an executive order for immigration reform. Thanks for listening to Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. We are much more than just a public policy and lobbying firm. We are a leading international legal practice that excels in the areas where government, law, and business meet. We understand countries, cultures, and how business works across the globe. We use our expertise to deliver tailored solutions to the individual challenges our clients face, when and where they need them. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The United States faces a moral crisis that strikes at the very heart of our democracy. Americans who live in our nation's capital have no representation in Congress. Like American citizens in the 50 states, they pay federal taxes, fight and die in wars. But when our heroes come home, they are stripped of a basic political right that most of us take for granted. They have no voice in our national legislature. D.C. deserves equal representation in Congress. Go to dcvote.org to learn how you can help end this injustice.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Hi, welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're joined by Clark Irwin, the former Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security. Tonight, as you know, President Obama is scheduled to make a primetime appearance from the White House to make an announcement about his new immigration policy, and we're going to talk to Clark a little bit about that. So, Clark, maybe let's start at the 30,000-foot level. What do you think are going to be the highlights of the president's announcement this evening?
Well, Kevin, looks like he's going to say that the parents of young people who are U.S. citizens or legal residents can stay indefinitely without fear of deportation. It's unclear the magnitude of the numbers we're talking about. It could be as high as 5 million, somewhere between 3 million and 5 million or so. But importantly, it seems as though the parents of so-called dreamers, who are kids who are themselves undocumented, but who were given a reprieve from deportation by the president back in 2012, the so-called Deferred Action Program, won't be included in this program. I should also mention that apparently the president is also going to give work permits to foreign graduates of U.S. colleges and universities in so-called STEM fields, so science, technology, engineering, and math.
And I'm sure that'll be highly popular with Silicon Valley and some other high-tech industries that are short of jobs. I think the number one thing we'll hear about in the run-up to this tonight and certainly in the pundit discussion afterwards is whether or not this action is constitutional. So talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. Well, everybody should dust off their old constitutional law books. It's going to be a really interesting question. You know, typically the courts, the federal courts, the Supreme Court ultimately decline to get involved in what they call political disputes. And a dispute between the executive branch and the legislative branch, which is what this is a quintessentially political dispute. On the other hand, there are lots of examples of the courts not doing that. You know, take a look at the Nixon tapes case, for example. And then, of course, most recently, recently, the Bush-Gore. That's the quintessential political case. So my bet is that the Supreme Court would grant cert for this once it makes its way through the federal court system. There's no question but that there's going to be a constitutional legal challenge that the Republicans will bring. And, you know, all bets are off as to how the court would come down. I think there's a better than even chance that the court would strike it down.
Well, it certainly whatever we get, as you say, is going to redraw the boundaries of presidential power and congressional power here. I guess the other fascinating thing for from a policy perspective is why and why now? I mean, the president, by making this announcement today, is jeopardizing his lame duck set of issues with the remaining days that Democrats have the majority in the Senate and a chance for him to get some things accomplished. But he's also, if you believe Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, who had post-election press conferences 2 weeks ago, they both said doing this will poison the well for the relationship. So talk to us about the why now.
Well, you know, I think the president is really boxed in here. He had promised, of course, famously that there would be action on this before the election. And then in the summer, because of concerns that taking action before the election would endanger already very endangered Democrats, decided to defer action until after the election. So now he's committed to doing so, and he is committed to having made a decision by the end of the year. And so the president is duty-bound to do it. There was a precipitous drop-off in Hispanic turnout in the election, and that is largely, if not entirely, due to the Hispanic community's disappointment with the president for having not honored the promise that he made earlier this year. There is no question in my mind that this really will poison the well for whatever chance, may have been a slim chance, but whatever chance there may have been for cooperation between the president and the Congress for the remainder of his term.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You and I were talking during the break about how Hispanic turnout was down, and then Republicans did well with the Hispanics that did actually turn out in a couple of key gubernatorial races in large border states, and then in some Senate races where clearly a point or two of Hispanic turnout in the way they have voted in recent elections would have turned the tide there.
Right.
So let's talk about the Republican reaction. If we agree that it's going to poison the well, maybe spin out to us what you think that they will do as both a legislative and a legal strategy.
Well, there's a bit of a conundrum for Republicans, too, because on the one hand, as you just said, Senator McConnell, the incoming majority leader, has said that two things are off the table going forward. There will not be any shutdown of the government. That was disastrous politically for the Republicans when that's been done in the recent past. And there won't be any default on the national debt. On the other hand, there's the other wing of the Republican Party, the Tea Party wing, that says all bets are off if the president does this, including shutting down the government, including not moving forward on any of the president's nominees. So there's going to be a big tug of war between the establishment branch of the Republican Party, which is ascendant in Washington now, and the insurgent branch. And as we get closer to the 2016 presidential election, and we'll be well into that by the middle of 2015, the presidential wing, which is more aligned, I would argue, because of the conservatism of the primary, the early primary states, with the Tea Party faction, I think will have the upper hand. So it's going to be very difficult indeed.
It's a great observation that the establishment wing of the Republican Party really had an extremely successful election night a few weeks ago. There weren't a lot of Tea Party folks, unlike 2010, that the Tea Party folks that brought the House to Republican majority, that's not who brought the Senate to a Republican majority in this election. It really does factor into all of the decisions they make. One of the things Republicans are talking about is bifurcating the appropriations process,
right,
and passing maybe a short-term bill now, so that when they take the majority in the spring, they can revisit this issue, but also just splitting apart what has been an omnibus bill and separating out the Homeland Security functions, the people who give out the green cards, who give out the documentation, etc. You obviously came from Homeland Security where you were Inspector General. Talk to us a little bit about just the practical implications of what that means for our national security and whether or not that's even possible.
Sure. Well, there's been a lot of talk. The deadline for funding the government is December 11. There's been a lot of talk about proceeding to do that, but defunding only the portion, as you were suggesting, of the budget that would allow for the implementation of the president's executive order. That's certainly one route. You know, I think query whether, as a practical matter, that would work, really. I mean, the funding of the Department of Homeland Security is so intertwined. We're talking about 22 different components. That might be very difficult as a practical matter to do, but that is one strategy.
So the president's strategy all along has seemed to be built along the assumption that Republicans will overreact
and that they will cause themselves harm with diverse populations like Hispanics, and that will give his party an advantage in the 2016 election and whatnot. So if you were the lead counsel to Speaker Boehner and incoming Majority Leader McConnell, what sort of advice do you offer them on how to make sure that they react appropriately to the president without changing public opinion against their own party?
Right. Well, you know, I would also wear a political hat in giving that advice. I would distinguish between the president's executive action and the issue of whether that's legal, whether that's appropriate constitutionally, and the substantive issue of whether there should be immigration reform. On the former, you know, there was a recent poll out today, a Wall Street Journal MSNBC poll that shows 48% of people think that the executive order is unconstitutional. It's an overreach on the president's part. But there's 74% approval for comprehensive immigration reform. So if I were an advisor to the Republicans, I'd say pass a bill, if not the Senate bill, the bill that the Senate passed a couple of years ago. Instead, pass your own bill, and at the same time, pursue very aggressively a legal action against the president's executive order. I'd bifurcate the two.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I think if I was the advisor, what I would say to the to those guys is pass bills, plural, because it seems to me Americans have shown a great deal of distrust for the mega bills, like a Dodd-Frank, right, like an Affordable Care Act. And the Republican approach has been to start with border security, work your way to internal security, work your way to high tech, and, you know, do this piecemeal.
Exactly.
Pass a bill a week, send it to the president's desk, and dare him not to sign border enforcement, not to sign internal enforcement.
That's right.
And work your way up instead of asking people to consume a 1,000-page bill at once. So that seems to be, though, 2015 matters. And I guess my question is, do you think Congress will effectively take anything on in the immigration area in 2014 with the few days we have remaining?
Well, as you said, Kevin, we really do have a few days remaining. I think if there was any chance of any action at all on immigration during the lame duck session, the fact that the president's going to take this action tonight means that there won't be. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think this really will poison the well politically. I think all bets are off now, and I just don't think that will happen. I think it's regrettable because, as I say, there is a substantive need, certainly political, for immigration reform, and there's a political need for the Republican Party to move on this. But if anything happens, it won't happen until 2015.
Yeah, I'm always cynical to note that the president had control of both chambers of Congress and didn't do it then, but now that Republicans have control, he's got to do it before they take action.
Politics in Washington.
Indeed. The politics is normal in Washington. Well, we've been joined by Clark Irvin from Squire Patton Boggs. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more Capital Thinking in just a moment.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Need to keep up to date with regulatory matters? Looking to expand your business globally? We've got enviable connections in D.C., Brussels, and beyond, with commercially focused teams to advise on the current and future legislation that you need to know about. With 44 offices in 21 countries located in major global cities, we can make that happen. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. Let us make sure your voice is heard. We have been helping clients for more than 50 years as the leading U.S. law firm for public policy and lobbying. Our team and our connections give you an unmatched ability to meet your public policy objectives, whatever the size or focus of your organization. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Squire Patton Boggs, LLP. We are much more than just a public policy and lobbying firm. We are a leading international legal practice that excels in the areas where government, law, and business meet. We understand countries, cultures, and how business works across the globe. We use our expertise to deliver tailored solutions to the individual challenges our clients face, when and where they need them. Squire Patton Boggs, the global law firm providing business insight at the point where law, business, and policy meet. To find out how we can help you, visit SquirePattonBoggs.com. Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Squire Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You can contact us at 202-457-6000.
The United States faces a moral crisis that strikes at the very heart of our democracy. Americans who live in our nation's capital have no representation in Congress. Like American citizens in the 50 states, they pay federal taxes, fight and die in wars. But when our heroes come home, they are stripped of a basic political right that most of us take for granted. They have no voice in our national legislature. D.C. deserves equal representation in Congress. Go to dcvote.org to learn how you can help end this injustice.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're going to turn our attention abroad now, talk a little bit about international trade. Joining us is Frank Simolas, a regular guest here on Capital Thinking, who can update us on some of the things that are going on in the international community. Now, Frank, I know you just got back from, I'd call it a European vacation a la Chevy Chase, but it's really a tour post-election of European capitals. Tell us a little bit about what's going on abroad.
Sure, Kevin, and thanks for having me back. Always nice to be here. I was in Europe last week in Frankfurt and in Warsaw, Poland, speaking about the ongoing U.S.-EU trade negotiations. The acronym is TTIP, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. The talks were launched, remember, about a year ago, and they're just beginning to get into a high stage of development and awareness. So the AmCham in Frankfurt asked me to speak to them about the American perspective on the talks, particularly after our midterm elections. The Consul General, the U.S. Consul General from Frankfurt, was there. Their consulate is larger than their embassy in Berlin, to show you the size of the U.S. consulate. Frankfurt, the financial center. A lot of interest on financial services. A similar presentation in Warsaw, where I spoke to the executive board of the AmCham Poland group. Very interested in our election results, very interested on the U.S. perspective on trade.
Very good. Well, we were just talking in the last segment about immigration reform, which has the potential to screw everything up with the president's agenda and maybe Congress's priorities. So let's just for a moment pretend that that situation doesn't exist. Let me ask you what you expect rolling forward with the transatlantic, the TTIP, and the trans-Pacific trade talks.
Right. You know, you remember, Kevin, the authority for the president to conclude these negotiations, something called Trade Promotion Authority, expired 7 years ago, 2007. So at some point, some president will need that authority in order to get these agreements, both TPP and TTIP, through the Congress under fast track. Ironically, the results of the midterm elections create a better climate for trade. Because with a Republican Congress, they're typically more sympathetic to open markets, free trade positions.
More sympathetic to TP, Trade Promotion Authority.
Yes, exactly. So I think this is one of those areas where it's a win-win for both the White House and the Congress. They can both demonstrate that they're working together. It's not a toxic topic like health care or immigration that causes a lot of division. This one, I think, will show everybody working together for the common good of the American economy, growing jobs, all those good things.
So we're just coming off elections here in Europe. They're transitioning to a new trade chief. Tell us a little bit about her and maybe how she impacts these discussions.
Right. Cecilia Malmström is the director of DG Trade. She's essentially their cabinet-level negotiator on the same level as U.S. Chair Michael Froman. She's a Swede. She is generally an open trader. She has made some announcements recently regarding the transparency of these talks, a big issue because of what happened in the TPP. A lot of complaints about the texts were being held back. They weren't being released to members of Congress. Chairman Darrell Issa at one point was so upset that he publicly leaked one of the negotiating texts, saying this is the only way people can find out what's in this very important document. So the Europeans saw what happened there. They wanted a more open system. Malmström said, we are going to give draft text to every member of the European Parliament, basically saying every member of the U.S. Congress. They can look at it. They can't take it out of the reading room, but they can have access to any text that we have. And secondly, they said, a finalized negotiating text will be made available to the public. That is, after all the deals are cut, we're going to disclose this to the public. So she's already laying down the marker for a more transparent system, one that I think that's going to benefit both the European public and the American public, because I think the U.S. government is going to be much more open on TTIP than they were on TPP.
Let me transition back across the water here. We've just come off the internal elections in Congress about who will be leadership, and Paul Ryan's been named the incoming chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, which has oversight of trade. Tell us a little bit about his record and ideas on trade.
Well, Kevin, he is a classic mainstream Republican free trader. He likes open markets. He doesn't like restrictions on negotiating authority. So I think for those of you in the audience that like open markets and free trade agreements, he will be a big champion as much as any Republican in the leadership in either the House or the Senate. We'll see who is going to be put onto the chairmanship of the Trade Subcommittee. I think it'll be Charles Bustani of Louisiana, another very good free trader, and I think they're both members who are going to work with the White House to come up with an agreement that makes sense. So it's a great platform for Paul Ryan, obviously, chairman of that committee. On trade, it's perfect for him and for his philosophy. He's voted for the FTAs in the past, so he's lined up to be in a very good position.
So flip it over to the Senate, where because control has changed, who has the gavel changes. You have Orrin Hatch,
right,
from Utah, will come in as chairman. Ron Wyden, who was briefly the chairman after Max Baucus resigned to become eventually the ambassador to China, will become the ranking member. What are their trade positions? What changes over there because of the control issue?
It shouldn't be too much of a change. Kevin Hatch, again, has been a traditional Republican free trader. He does not like limitations to address labor concerns, environmental concerns. The one change I would mention is that when the Democrats controlled the Senate, you probably would have seen more provisions added for organized labor, for environment. That would create a conflict with the House. With Republicans in both the House and the Senate, I think everybody will be of the same mind. So there will be a package that will be fairly similar right from the beginning, then sent to the president.
Very good. So you're just back from Europe. President Obama, after the election, he went off on a long Asia trip and a summit there with Pacific leaders. Obviously a significant announcement on greenhouse emissions with China, and now he's back. Does that greenhouse agreement with China signal some sort of broader effort to get a bilateral treaty between the two? And is this sort of the typical legacy hunting that we see second-term presidents get engaged on?
I think that's part of it. I think it's a classic second-term president looking to create his legacy overseas. And what better and bigger relationship than U.S. and China? The big issue, the big prize, is a bilateral investment treaty, what we call a BIT, between the U.S. and China. Both sides agreed they want to enter into that agreement. This is a very difficult agreement to finalize. So if Obama can do it on his watch, more power to him, but that's a pretty ambitious schedule. At the same time, Obama announced a BIT, a bilateral investment treaty, with India. They'll start talks there. So you're right. I think he's already sort of crafting a legacy in the international area, which in many ways can be an easier road for him than dealing with the Republican Congress.
Does a bit get complicated by the fact it's clear that, that China, while not directly engaged in the Trans-Pacific talks, is setting themselves up as almost an alternative with some of their investments and whatnot. Does that complicate the effort to get a bid?
Great question, Kevin. It complicates sort of the big picture, because remember the TPP ministerials, TPP does not include China, the ministerial was held on the margins of the APEC summit in China. China has their own version of TPP, which is a regional Asian agreement that does not include the United States. They announced as part of this package, we want to have a free trade area of Asia that would include the U.S., include the TPP, include our regional trade agreement. That is very ambitious. It is an indication, it wasn't rejected by the U.S., that there certainly is room to discuss a really broad regional trade agreement, including the U.S. and China. You get so big, at some point you wonder, why didn't we just do this in the WTO, which is supposed to do the multilateral agreements, but be that
right, the club gets so big, it's not worth being a member.
Right.
Well, let me wrap up. Congress has just a couple of weeks remaining before they call it quits for 2014. Do you see any sort of movement on trade issues during the lame duck session?
No, I don't think so. People have talked about it, and respected members like Senator Portman have called for TPA to be brought up in the lame duck. I don't think the politics work in favor of a trade bill. Any other trade bill other than TPA follows behind in the wake of TPA. So trade adjustment assistance, a big issue for the Democrats, is going to be held back until there's an agreement on TPA. The same for the Africa trade bill that expires next year. The same for the GSP program, which has already expired. All of those are too small in and of themselves to get traction in a lame duck. So I would predict there'll be no trade action in a lame duck, but Obama will be big on trade in the State of the Union. The Republicans will agree this is a great idea, let's work together, and I think it'll be one of those short list items where you may see action early on next year.
Great. Well, we've been joined by Frank Simolas. That's going to wrap it for this week's Capital Thinking. We want to wish everyone a very happy Thanksgiving. We'll be back later with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.